From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, politicians turn up the heat under MSU and its president over the Larry Nassar debacle.
There's no way that Michigan State University or any public university is immune to the vicissitudes of politics.
A new documentary film shows the resilience of the people of Flint recovering from poisoned water.
Because of what has happened in Flint, we may have been able to save many, many children from going through what we've been going through.
Two Olympic skaters explain why are so many international skaters training in Detroit and at what cost.
So there's a lot of family sacrifices sometimes is to be made in order for the skaters to continue and to achieve their goals.
And what ancient dog DNA tells us about man's best friend. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time for MSU President Luana Simon to step down. That blunt message came from State House Speaker Tom Leonard. He's one of several high-profile state politicians who've criticized the MSU administration in the last week for its handling of sexual assault complaints against former sports doctor Larry Nassar. Democratic candidate for governor Gretchen Whitmer called for an independent investigation of MSU. Candidate for attorney general, former U.S. Attorney Pat Miles, is calling for greater accountability. And attorney general and Republican candidate for governor Bill Schuette is calling on MSU's private attorney to release the results of the firm's examination. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here with us now. Rick, this has been a big national news story, even an international story, for over a year. Why are we seeing politicians on both sides coming out and calling for more accountability from MSU now?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. I mean, the moment is right now that Larry Nassar has pleaded guilty and is being sentenced, that Nassar's victims are stepping forward and complaining that the university is not forthcoming. And, you know, there are still revelations, you know, things like the fact that the university hired an outside legal counsel to do a review of the university's handling of the Nassar situation. And in the course of that review, apparently never wrote anything down. So there are just these surprises that keep coming along, and now the legislature's getting engaged in ways that aren't good, at least for, you know, President Luana Simon.
Who's vulnerable to political attacks for not saying or doing something sooner regarding MSU and Larry Nassar?
Well, keep in mind, politicians do things because they expect that's what the public expects, that that's what the public wants. And, you know, that's a lot of what we're seeing here, you know, that we can't ignore the fact that political ambitions may be in play, that House Speaker Tom Leonard is hoping to be the Republican candidate for Attorney General. State Senator Tanya Schutmaker, who's met with the victims and is now calling for legislative hearings, would also like to be the Republican nominee for Attorney General. Every hopeful for Attorney General in both the Republican and the Democratic Party have said that MSU should be subject of an independent investigation. So, you know, all of that is not a coincidence.
Now, how does all of this ramp up the pressure on President Simon and the MSU Board of Trustees, which we should note answered the Lansing State Journal editorial by insisting it stands with her?
Mm-hmm. Well, it turns up the pressure on a number of fronts. First of all, MSU's handling of the Larry Nassar case has now become a political issue. The Michigan State University Board of Trustees are elected. Two positions will be open in 2018. And usually these elections are basically a measure of core partisan support among the voters. But now, both in the nominating process, that these are candidates who are nominated at state party conventions, that MSU's handling of this case could become an issue, support for President Luana Simon could be an issue, and that could spill over into the general election as well. So that's thing one. Thing two is House Speaker Tom Leonard has said that if MSU is not more forthcoming on how it handled the Larry Nassar situation and who knew what and when, that state aid to Michigan State University could be at stake as well. Not to mention, we are almost certainly in 2018 going to see legislative hearings, and people could be called in to testify, and they could be called in to testify under oath.
It is really something when you think of the potential pitfalls if this thing becomes too politicized.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, look, MSU is a public university. It's run by an elected board, and it relies on money appropriated by the legislature for about 20% of its budget. There's no way that Michigan State University or any public university is immune to the vicissitudes of politics.
So here we have Attorney General Schuette saying, I want to know who knew what and when. MSU's private investigator saying, well, there is no report for me to turn over to you. So what are the possibilities? What are the options for us to find out who knew what and when?
Well, certainly there will be civil lawsuits, and there will be discovery in the process of that if the university doesn't settle with the victims. And I mean, there are more than 100 of them. Another possibility would be that a law enforcement agency, the Michigan State Police or the FBI perhaps, would have some suspicion of criminal wrongdoing on the part of university officials, and they could open a criminal investigation. And the other, of course, is some lawmakers have already called for legislative hearings into how MSU handled the situation, and we could see MSU officials called in to testify before a legislative committee.
You say that you've seen parallels between the way MSU and President Simon handled the Nassar debacle and the way that state officials and Governor Rick Snyder responded to the Flint water crisis. What are these?
The parallels would appear to be that there was a problem. Attention was called to the fact that it might exist, and that was ignored by higher-ups who say that they just didn't know. But it also says that they didn't take it seriously when the prospect first emerged. They allowed the problem to linger and then fester, and then after it became plain that a problem existed, that leaders were slow to respond with empathy to the victims of that particular disaster.
You make some very great points, well spelled out parallels. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. As always, Rick, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
The state's Pipeline Safety Board met Monday, and they made it clear they want a temporary shutdown of that controversial pipeline running under the Straits of Mackinac. Or should we say, some members of the board made it clear. Enbridge's Line 5 has been under scrutiny because of its age, over 60 years old, and with problems with its protective coating. Michigan Radio's Shana Roth is here now talking about recommendations the board made after Governor Snyder struck a deal with Enbridge, which is one of Michigan Radio's corporate sponsors. So, Shana, let's start with Enbridge. Going into the meeting, we knew the company would be getting grilled by the board, and turned out that happened for about an hour. What did we learn?
So what we learned is a couple of things. You know, Enbridge has said that they are diligently working on all of these safety measures that they and the governor worked on. However, there were some questions that they got from the board that they weren't able to answer. For example, they still don't know what is causing these gaps in the protective coating. The response by the members of the board to them was kind of mixed. Even Valerie Brader, who's a co-chair, I spoke with her right after Enbridge gave their presentation. You know, she said that she's happy that Enbridge apologized for, you know, some of the, I guess you could call it, misleading information about what's going on with the pipeline. But she says, you know, they still got a ways to go.
All right, let's take a listen.
I'm glad that the new agreement gives two state employees the ability to come in and look at this beside them so that we're not dependent on them looking through their own files to give us the information that's there. I'm also glad that we have required meetings at which their information will have to be produced. But obviously, there's still a long way to go.
All right. And there were some surprise resolutions from the safety board, led by three members, including member Jennifer McKay, who did not feel the deal the Governor Snyder struck with Enbridge went far enough. Let's listen to what she told you.
The coating issue, obviously, we know we have coating gaps. It's in violation of the easement, and it only makes sense to shut down the pipeline until Enbridge can adequately address and fix the coating issues to ensure that we don't have any type of rupture or leak in the Straits of Mackinac.
So shut her down temporarily?
That's what several members of the board wanted. And they had three resolutions. That was kind of the big one that really stuck out to people, because obviously there were a lot of environmentalists there who have been calling for the pipeline to be shut down for years. Another one is that they want to change some of the safety requirements. Right now, the agreement says that they have to stop using the pipeline when there are 8-foot waves. They want to lower that. And then they also want more analysis on, you know, why does Michigan need the Line 5? And they want another study of alternatives to the pipeline.
Now, it's interesting to learn that there were 7 abstention votes on this. Talk about that, because clearly this board is not united.
Right. And that's where things got very confusing, because apparently their rules didn't make it clear what you do when a majority of the board doesn't vote no, but abstains. Depending on which resolution it was, for the most part, you had about 5 people voting yes. In one case, there were 6 yeses, and then the rest abstained. The attorney general's representative abstained. The MSP representative abstained. Co-chair Valerie Brader abstained. And one of their reasons that they kind of publicly said was this was thrown at us. We didn't know that this was going to happen. We haven't had time to read through these resolutions carefully, and these are big things that we want to examine. But when it came down to, hey, maybe we should say whether or not these resolutions passed or not, that was where the confusion really started to come in, and they kind of, you know, pulled up their bylaws. They pulled up the Roberts Rules of Order. And at the end of it, the board chair did say, you know, according to how we're interpreting our rules, these resolutions did pass, and we are going to send them to the governor.
But they're not binding, are they?
Right.
So what does this mean? I mean, kind of what power, if any, does this Pipeline Safety Board wield?
That was a question that a lot of people had during the public comment section of this meeting is, you know, if the governor is able to just go and on his own without consulting with the board as a whole and make these types of deals with Enbridge, you know, what is the purpose of the board? What is their function? And yes, these resolutions are purely advisory. The governor can look at them. He can, you know, take them into consideration, or he cannot. But if you ask members of the board, I think what they would say is, you know, they are an oversight committee. They are, you know, they are to give recommendations. And they do believe that the governor, because he did create this board, would listen to them on various topics.
Did Enbridge have any comment after the meeting, particularly about this resolution for temporary shutdown?
No. Myself and several reporters chased after a couple of Enbridge people, and they said that they would come out with some sort of a statement later, but they were not prepared for these resolutions. But so far, we have not received a statement.
Michigan Radio's Shana Roth. Thanks, Shana.
Thank you.
Up next, a new documentary film called Fort Flint shows the resilience of its people as they recover from poisoned water. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Inspiration in the wake of desperation. That's the theme of a powerful documentary film called For Flint. Director Brian Schulz shows us the foundation for rebuilding Flint lies in the lives of its people.
You know, every time I come over here, it brings back old memories. Some good, some bad. The houses and things of that nature that used to be here, and the people no longer here.
In the last 10 to 15 years, we've been through quite a bit. We've been on lists for the worst place to live and high crime.
It really makes you feel like we are in a third world country.
And with us now are 2 of the 3 Flint residents that are profiled in this documentary. Leon El Alamin is the founder and executive director of MADE Institute. MADE stands for Money, Attitude, Direction, and Education. And Valerie Horton is a former General Motors worker who is an artist. She's the co-director of the Chosen Few Arts Council. Welcome to both of you to Stateside. So good to have you with us.
Thank you for having us.
So those of you who call Flint home, you've certainly seen no shortage of journalists and others in the media in the years since the water crisis story became known to the world. And there are people in Flint who've express some frustration or fatigue with all this media attention. So I'm wondering, why did you agree to be a part of this film, Leon?
Well, definitely. Flint is my home. You know, I've been born and raised here my whole life. I'm 37 years old, and I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. For a large part of my life, my adolescent years, I went off the wrong path and caused a lot of destruction and damage to the reality that we see now as Flint, contributed to it. And I just think it was only right once I got myself together mentally to come back and help out in any kind of way that I can to help bring back Flint.
And so you felt letting a documentary crew follow you around and kind of sharing your story would help that cause?
That actually kind of stumbled up on that. We were doing the work with what we do at MAID Institute, is working with ex-offenders coming out of prison or jail and at-risk youth. And during the water crisis, the early stages, we decided to turn our office space into a water distribution site and free lead testing because we were getting a lack of water distributed on the city's north side. And in the process of doing that type of work, as well as other community activism work, we stumbled up and had opportunity to meet with Brian Schultz. And he just laid out his vision of what he wanted to do, and it just kind of coincided, and we worked together on bringing it about.
So, Valerie, what about you? Why did you say, all right, I will be a part of this film? What was your motivation?
Well, we've heard so many negative things about Flint. And I'm in my 60s, and I was here when Flint was thriving and really kind of ushered in the middle class for the United States, and I've watched it decline. When Brian called me and someone referred him to me, I agreed to meet with him, and we met and we talked a little bit. He interviewed me, and I kind of interviewed him too, and one of my things that I told him was I wanted to be sure that it showed a positive light on Flint, because there are a lot of positive things happening.
And that's a chance for us to find out about the work both of you are doing. Now, Leon, you were incarcerated for, I understand, about 9 years?
I did actually 7 behind the walls and 2 years on parole for drugs and gun possessions.
And what turned you around, and here you are now trying to give back to your hometown through the MAID Institute?
It was a combination of things. I was 21 when I came through the system. My life was out of control. I was, you know, really involved in the streets as a hustler, and a lot of my friends were beginning to be killed because of the lifestyle we once all were a part of, in the drug trade and gangs and things like that. Dysfunctional family at the time, heavy into alcohol, and I seen a lot of that becoming more prevalent in the neighborhood that was once a middle-class neighborhood. And in the process of going into prison in 2003, I was set up and shot in my head and left to die. And I knew subconsciously I was thinking that something has to change in my life. I was headed towards death. And crazy as it may sound, the term in prison actually kind of saved my life, because I really had no mentors or positive influences that was trying to steer me in the right direction when I was out here. By that time, I was just kind of gone and lost in my own way. And then while I was incarcerated, I had the opportunity to meet a couple of people who was doing life, who really became like mentors to me and impressed upon me about making better decisions in my life and helped me recognize that I had a lot of influence on my peers. And if I was just to channel that energy into something positive, that I can have a greater impact in some people's lives and do greater things. And I took that to heart. And while serving my time behind the walls, I began to reach into my spirituality, history, and I read a lot. You know, I had a real long talk with God, and he just put it up on my heart that if I was given another chance, an opportunity to come back out here, that I wanted to do something positive. I wanted to be a part of positive change and reach some young folks and steer them down a better path. And I just wanted to give back because I felt like I had took so much away from the community.
And I think Brian Schultz, in bringing us your story in this documentary for Flint, does do a beautiful job of showing how you are taking that positive energy and you are pumping it out into your hometown. That's clear. And so are you, Valerie Horton, 33 years at General Motors, and now you are an artist, you're a potter. And I was really struck, we're going to play a little clip from the film, something that you said that really strikes a hopeful note.
When I began working in clay, one of my instructors stated that you always need to know the end product. I really believe that as in clay, starting with just a clump of dirt, that we will begin to see something very beautiful come out of what's going on in Flint.
So Valerie Horton, how are you taking that hopeful attitude and putting it into the Chosen Few Arts Council to help your city?
Years before I interacted with Brian, my family has been giving back to the community all of my life. I raised my children that they need to be always part of the solution of things that are happening. My children are, both of them, are artists, musicians, but we began working in the schools, going into the schools, and just letting the children in the schools know that there were people in the community that cared about them. We did that for a couple of years, and it became a toll on our pocketbook, so we decided to develop a 501c3, and in 2010, we became a nonprofit. We then developed a program that we piloted in one of the charter schools and began to teach art classes to kids in those schools. It's been a blessing, and we know, especially with the water crisis, kids need to know that art is not just drawing. You know, the things that will help them with the issues that they're going to have because of being connected with the lead issue will be things like understanding I can make choices, being creative and understanding that I can do this. There's no, I can't do this. They make wonderful art pieces, and it's been a blessing. It's been a blessing for us, and it's been a blessing for the community.
So, yes, you're offering drawing, creative arts, music, and it was going on before the water crisis, and it looks into the future. And now that you've both seen this film, this short documentary for Flint that you're in, what do you think it says to the world about Flint, Leon?
That we're resilient, that we are recovering slowly but surely, that it has great people here. And there's still people here that really care about the conditions and other individuals here. I think that there's definitely an eye-opener to a lot of people kind of written us off. And I think with the film and the work that's being done, it's sending a strong statement that we won't give up and we're going to see this thing through and we're going to come out of it a lot better.
And Valerie, you get the last word. What does this film say to the world about your city?
Well, just like I said in the film, I really believe that something beautiful is going to happen. We are resilient, as Leon said, and one of the things that it has done is it's put the light on the lead issue, and cities across the United States are now checking their lead levels and their levels in their schools. And, you know, because of what has happened in Flint, we may have been able to save many, many children from going through what we've been going through. So, unfortunately, it had to happen here, but we're resilient. We can get up, we can do positive things, and we can be a focal point for the United States and for the world.
The documentary short film for Flint will be screened tonight at 7 p.m. at the Flint Institute of Arts. Director Brian Schultz, producer Matthew Mills will be there along with Valerie Horton and Leon Al Alamin. There'll be a screening, a post-film discussion and reception, and it's all free and open to the public. Leon and Valerie, it was great to meet you through the film and even better to talk with you here on Stateside. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Time for another edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here now with the latest look at productions from professional theater companies around the state. And the theme this time, no surprise here, is Christmas. And we start in Marshall at the Great Escape Theater Company.
That's right. It's just east of Kalamazoo, and they are running Truman Capote's Christmas Memory. And this is based on Capote's semi-autobiographical 1956 short story about a 7-year-old boy coming of age during the Depression in small-town Alabama. Okay. It's a musical. And this is actually just one adaptation that of this story that includes a trilogy of feature films as well as a Hallmark made-for-TV movie. It's a very sentimental, and it's a lovely show. And Marshall, by the way, is really decked out for Christmas. They take Christmas and the holidays very seriously. So it's a really enjoyable trip to that town. And for the theater, all around for the family.
Yes, sounds perfect if you're looking for something that's a little different, Christmassy on stage. We all love A Christmas Carol, but everybody does that a lot, or The Nutcracker. This is something a little different, and what a great field trip going
Absolutely,
to Marshall.
Yeah.
Now we head over to the Wharton Center, and I am personally excited to talk about this one because I was lucky enough to see Finding Neverland with Matthew Morrison on Broadway. And you just sail out. You're so happy after this show.
Well, it's a lovely show. And this is the musical based on the story of playwright J.M. Barrie becoming a writer and how he was inspired by a real family to conceive the story of Peter Pan and the Lost Boys. The film won an Academy Award, and the play, which has, as you say, enjoyed a wonderful, successful run on Broadway, is now enjoying a very successful tour. This is a terrific family outing.
Can you remember back when you were young, when all the simple things you did were so much fun? You got lost somewhere along the way. You've forgotten how to play every single day. Am I right?
It is. It's, and take it from me, we all just sailed out and said this was really a wonderful moment, and we saw it in the fall. I can't even imagine how much better to see it at Christmas time. And there will be some familiar Christmas music heard at Detroit's Fisher Theater.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening?
That's right. This is called Christmas Wonderland. And it's one of those Christmas spectacular shows for the whole family. And it's a visual extravaganza. You have Santa and his merry helpers taking you on a nostalgic journey. And we hear songs that we all love to hear, like White Christmas and Winter Wonderland, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, and many more Christmas standards. There's a cast of 24 singers and dancers. And they all come. They come from London and New York and Las Vegas and Los Angeles.
So good caliber.
Yes, really good. And they transform the Fisher stage into an absolute, as the title suggests, a winter wonderland, just magical atmosphere. There's over 1,000 costumes that glitter and sparkle, and the sets are spectacular. It's, if you can still get a ticket, get one, because you won't be disappointed.
Tremendous fun. We're going to head north up Woodward to 9 Mile and Ferndale to the Ringwald Theater.
This is a different kind of a story for Christmas. It's David Sedaris' Santa Land Diaries. And, of course, public radio fans should be familiar with David Sedaris. And this runs for 1 week only. There's an actor who will do this. He's a kind of a Ringwald favorite. He's won Wild Awards. His name is Richard Payton. And he will be doing the monologues, and he'll play the different parts and as David Sedaris does. And it's definitely edgy, not necessarily for the kiddies. If you've heard David Sedaris on public radio, and probably a lot of your listeners have, you kind of know the flavor.
Yes.
You know,
so perhaps holiday with a tinge of acid.
A little bit, a little bit.
Just a touch.
And then a quick trip up to Marine City to the Riverbank Theater, and again, Marine City really does a nice job of creating Christmas atmosphere. They're doing the best Christmas pageant ever, which is a play that I appeared in one time. And it's a show within the show. It's, if you're involved in a church and you put on a Christmas pageant, you know any number of things can go wrong, from casting to the way the politics of the families and the mothers about who gets cast as what. It's a very funny show. It is for the whole family.
Okay.
And that's at the Riverbank in Marine City.
And then Theater Nova in Ann Arbor has A Year Without a Panto Clause.
Right. Well, panto is a particular kind of theater. It sort of comes from Britain, and it involves really kind of over-the-top, silly, some improvisational. The panto comes from the word pantomime, although there's a lot of spoken words. So But when Santa gets depressed, he decides to pack it in and disappear. That's the nature of the story. Two of his elves search far and near looking for some genuine Christmas cheer. And arriving at a few decidedly un-Christmassy locations, they face the wrath of the heat and snow miser twins, the tropical town's grumpy citizens, and a mysterious Russian bombshell named Vixen. It's silly.
It's silly.
It's silly by, it's supposed to be silly, but it's also meant to bring the whole family to boo and hiss and sing your way through the whole story. They engage the audience members at Theater Nova. I've been to these in the past, and they're quite fun, and the kids and the adults both like it.
Well, you certainly brought us a wide smorgasbord of fun holiday offerings. You can get all the details on these productions very easily. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thank you so much for the holiday offerings.
Thanks so much, and happy holidays to everyone.
Coming up, what brings so many international ice skaters to Michigan?
We have three major training centers within a 45-mile radius, and they attract skaters from all over the world. So it really is, has become a mecca for training figure skaters to the Detroit area.
That is in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. An archaeological dig can yield more than arrowheads or pottery shards or pieces of jewelry. It can also yield bones. A research team at the University of Michigan has been studying some ancient dog bones dug up in Germany, and they've uncovered new clues about just when our faithful domesticated dog evolved from wolves. Dr. Jeff Kidd is an assistant professor of human genetics and computational medicine and bioinformatics. Jeff, welcome. So you focus on genetics?
I am, absolutely. Sort of fundamentally interested in how our DNA gives rise to all the diversity we see, whether it's in people or dogs and wolves or anything else.
And thus, there you are, looking at the DNA of these ancient dogs found in Europe. How old? Tell us about these samples.
Yeah, so the two samples that my team and our collaborators from a number of places looked at are about 5,000 to 7,000 years old from Germany.
That qualifies as ancient.
Yeah.
So what do you do with the bones, and how do you extract this DNA that's so ancient?
Yeah, so of course there's a lot to these stories in terms of the archaeology and the field work to sort of understand the site and even identify them as a dog as opposed to some other animal based upon the bone. But where we come in is looking at the DNA sequence. So it turns out that even after an animal dies and its bones are in the ground for a long time, the DNA is still recoverable. And in fact, a key finding that's happened a couple years ago now is that there's a specific bone. It's called the Petrus bone. It's sort of the part of your inner ear in the back of your skull that's like a storehouse of DNA. And that for some reason, that bone just maintains high quality DNA for a very long time.
So you can extract that and just really basically look at the DNA that goes back to this animal that lived 7,000 years ago.
Exactly. So what my colleagues did is extracted that DNA and sequenced it. And then we compared it with sequence from 100 modern dogs and wolves from all over the world.
So what'd you learn?
So we learned a couple things. First, we sort of revisited an ongoing controversy about when and where dogs were domesticated. As you can imagine, dogs are man's best friend, right? People care very deeply about that history. And it also tells us something about how domestication itself and artificial selection can work. So a number of people have had theories about where dogs came from. Europe, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, a number of places have been proposed. Folks have argued, did domestication happen once? Did it happen multiple times? And what we saw when we compared the DNA sequences from the two samples from Germany, along with a previously published dog from around the same time in Ireland, is actually that we don't think there needs to be two domestications. We think that the data is totally consistent with a single domestication that happened quite a long time ago, perhaps up to 30,000 years, which is super old.
Yes. So when they kind of morphed or transformed from these wild wolves into what we think of as our domesticated Fido.
Exactly. But what complicates the picture is that just like humans, we now know, have moved all over the world and have complex history of gene flow migration changes to local environments. The same happened with dogs. So we have a very ancient split between sort of Eastern versus Western Eurasia of dogs.
And then you can also, by studying dog bones, make some comparisons to humans?
Absolutely. So one thing that we found that was sort of fascinating was that, so our samples are from Europe, of course, so we're very focused on what we could learn about Western Eurasia, is that the dogs that we sampled from Germany have ancestry components in them that trace back to similar to dogs that currently we find in India. So that tells us that dogs themselves have been migrating all over Eurasia for a long time, just like humans were.
Are dog bones also kind of comparable to human bones? Can you learn things that give you insights into early humans?
From the bones themselves, you know, people learn a lot in terms of the culture of groups, in terms of archaeology, and how sort of settlements related to each other, how animals were buried, how people were buried, that sort of type of thing.
Did you see how dog genetics changed and impacted their health?
That's sort of a motivating question for a lot of us, right? It's not just sort of, you know, when and where did dogs become dogs from wolves, but, you know, how did that happen? What are the genes that changed? And so we were able to take a look at a number of factors. So this ancient DNA, this ability to go back in time and sort of figure out, you know, what's the snapshot of diversity that existed 5,000-10,000 years ago is hugely powerful. And we were able to reassess, you know, some claims that people have made in terms of modern variation. And so there's a number of folks who've looked at modern dogs and found differences between modern dogs and modern wolves. And we go and look at our ancient samples, and we saw that in some cases, the ancient dog had the modern dog gene. So that potentially could be something that happened during domestication a long time ago. And other times they didn't, which tells us that looking just at the modern samples is sort of tricking us. We're sort of blind to the ancient events, and that what we're sometimes confusing is selection or adaptation that happened much more recently than the initial event.
Is there a similar human example?
Yeah. So this idea that when this sort of genetic changes started spreading through populations is something that ancient DNA has found also in humans. In humans, of course, a phenotype that a lot of people are familiar with is lactose intolerance, or the inability to digest milk as an adult. There's a genetic variant that's very common in Europeans that gives you the ability to digest milk when you're an adult. And that variant, it's very clear, has been under very strong recent selection. It's been spreading in the population. But human ancient DNA has told us that if we go back and look at Europeans several thousand years ago, even though they had agriculture and milk, that variant really wasn't that common. So that sort of spread of that ability to digest lactose in humans happened much more recently. And we think of something very similar is the case with dogs, but it's not the ability to digest milk, but the ability to metabolize or eat starch. Modern dogs, of course, eat a diet that's very different than ancient or modern wolves. And there's a very clear genetic change involving the gene amylase to digest starch that we see in dogs all around the world. But when we look in our ancient samples, we see that they don't really have that change, even though the people at the time had agriculture and grain would have been available. So there seems like there's a parallel story there of this time lag in terms of when these genetic beneficial variants really start to spread.
How does what happened so many thousands of years, how does that give you more insight, scientists more insight into health issues and genetic changes that we may be undergoing as humans in 2017?
Now, dogs are a great model for learning about human health and disease as well. So we share very similar environments. Anyone who's ever taken their dog to the vet knows that dogs get very sophisticated treatment from modern veterinary medicine, including pharmaceuticals that are relatively similar to humans. Dogs get cancer, of course, which is a disease of huge relevance to people. Understanding the genetic basis of dog disease often has direct impact into understanding common ways the human disease develops as well. And beyond just biomedicine and these things, another sort of fundamental question that dogs are super useful for is understanding how genes change to give diverse phenotypes. You, of course, look at dogs and you see a tremendous variety. Many, many people have seen this. It goes all the way back to Darwin, who noted domesticated animals have distinct changes in how they are relative to their wild offspring. And a number of folks have tried to do studies to understand, you know, how that happens and what's the fundamental way that genes and genomes change over time. And now with dogs and the ability to go back in time and directly use this ancient DNA time machine, we're beginning to unravel this in more and more specific detail to basically understand how evolution happened.
It feels like you and other geneticists are assembling this big jigsaw puzzle. And at times you're doing it almost with your eyes closed and trying to find that piece that fits in with another piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so dependent on our ability to both make very specific statistical models of genetic data, but to ultimately go and test them with what we actually see, both in animals that are alive now and now with this amazing ancient DNA technology to go back in time. It's really an exciting time. There's all kinds of hypotheses and new findings in dogs and humans all the time. And literally, I go to a meeting or open up a journal, and I never know what fossil someone got DNA from that's going to totally change our view of the past.
New information from ancient dogs. Fascinating work. Dr. Jeffrey Kidd, University of Michigan geneticist, we want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you. My pleasure.
What?
When?
Why?
I am curious.
Yes, it is time for Am I Curious, where you ask the question, we dig up the answer. Here's today's question.
This is Dan Major from Clinton Township, Michigan, and I'd like to know why so many international Olympic figure skaters train in Metro Detroit.
It's a timely question with the South Korea Winter Olympics right around the corner. To find the answer, we turn to the Detroit Skating Club in Oakland County in Bloomfield Township. It's one of several facilities in Michigan that turn out big-named Olympic skaters, names like Tara Lipinski, Federica Fiala, Massimo Scali, Virginia Baxter, to name just a few. Jared Swallow and his skater partner and wife, Elizabeth Punsalin, are five-time U.S. national champions in ice dancing, and they competed twice in the Olympics. These days, Jared Swallow is the managing director of the Detroit Skating Club. Jared, welcome.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And Yuka Sato skated for Japan in two Olympics. She was a world champion, and these days she's a national, international, world, and Olympic coach and choreographer for the Detroit Skating Club. Yuka, good to have you with us.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
It's exciting to talk to you, and I'll say I am a skating fan, so I'm personally having a very happy moment as I get to talk to two tremendous skaters. So, Jared, how did this come to be that Michigan is such a strong training ground that brings athletes from around the world? When and why did that happen for Michigan?
Well, I think one of the reasons we're more global today than we were is that we've got coaches that have immigrated from all over the world to set up shop, if you will, in Detroit. And with that, they've attracted an international level of athletes to come and train in Detroit. So compared to when we were training, we're much more global than the 90s, for sure.
Indeed. And the Detroit Skating Club isn't the only club in Michigan where top-tier skaters train. What are some other clubs in Michigan or hotspots for these world-caliber skaters?
We're very lucky. The coaches that have migrated to the state over several decades, they stay because we have facilities that can give them the time and the resources necessary to develop Olympic-level skaters. We've had coaches, actually, that have moved away from our club, and they developed their own programs. One is very successful in Canton, Michigan, at Arctic Edge Figure Skating Club, and also at the Novi City Rink. It's incredible that we have three major training centers within a 45-mile radius, and they attract skaters from all over the world. So it really has become a mecca for training figure skaters to the Detroit area.
Jared, how many international Olympic figure skaters and ice dancers are training right now at the Detroit Skating Club?
Well, Cindy, we have, leading into the Korean Olympic Games, let's see, probably four skaters that have a chance to make the team. One couple in particular from Turkey will have already qualified, so they'll be there. And then we have some young up-and-coming U.S. skaters that have a very good chance. We also have a Japanese pair team that will most likely be competing in Korea for the Japanese team events.
So, Yuka, give us the names of the Japanese pair team you're teaching so we can follow them along with their progress and say, okay, these are skaters from the Detroit Skating Club.
Yes, the pair team that I teach, their names are Miyu Suzaki and Ryuichi Kihara from Japan.
And to help answer Dan's Am I Curious question, we asked Miyu Suzaki and Ryuichi Kihara just what brought them from Japan to the Detroit area.
My name is Miyu Suzaki. I'm 17 years old.
I'm Ryuichi Kihara. I'm 25.
Right now, we train for Japanese national and Hope Olympics. We don't have ice rink in Japan, and we can't practice in Japan, so we came here. They have ice rink and gym and also dance studio, so that's good for us.
There is good coach.
This has to be exciting for you, Yuka, having been on that Olympic journey yourself, and now there you are helping lead these athletes forward on their Olympic path.
Yes, I got to experience the best part of the both worlds, one from being in the United States for the past about 20 years of, you know, living here, working full-time, and being able to work with a lot of American skaters. And at the same time, you know, I still get the taste of supporting right behind the Japanese team.
Yuka, when an international skater says, all right, I'm going to come and train with Yuka Sato, I'm going to the Detroit Skating Club, and I'm going to move halfway around the world, do they do it on their own? Do they come in groups? Do they come with family or training partners? How do you see it work out?
I think it varies really dependent on the situation and the people. Sometimes it's one of those things, timing is everything. Just one person comes and then there are a whole bunch of group of people come. It's sort of like following that one person. And sometimes the whole family moves. The Japanese team, the boy who skates, he is 25 years old, so he's here by himself. But his partner, who is only 17, her and her mother came together. So there's a lot of family sacrifices sometimes is to be made in order for the skaters to continue and to achieve their goals.
Yuka, you are a world champion. You are an Olympian from Japan. What made you decide to come coach in Michigan?
It's sort of my fate that I've always had close friends living or going to University of Michigan or some sort that I tend to have a lot of good relationship with this area, which wasn't by my choice, but it was very interesting. And, you know, the reason I'm still here is because of such a wonderful facility that I get to work in, which is Detroit Skating Club. I've taught here for many, many years, but also I've had such a great professional career as a performer. And I can say for both as a coach and a skater, this facility is just so wonderful. We have freedom of having a great quality of training sessions for the skaters. And also we have off-ice aspect of it with the trainers, physical therapist, and some of the other instructors that figure skating need for dance classes and the strengthening conditioning, and everything is happening under one roof. So for the athletes, it's just wonderful. And also at the same time for the developmental group to be introduced to the sport.
And Jared Swallow, I have to ask you about the big story in the news. What are your thoughts on the ban on Russia competing in the Winter Olympics coming up?
Well, I think, you know, the athletes themselves certainly have their opinions with regards to the integrity of the sport and the integrity of competing clean, but they're all very close. You know, as you mentioned, it's a global sport, but it's also a small world. So I think the athletes are certainly sad that some of their close friends and close competitors have to deal with this.
Jared Swallow, five-time U.S. national champion in ice dancing, two-time Olympic competitor, the managing director of the Detroit Skating Club, and Yuka Sato, 1994 Ladies World Champion, two-time Olympic competitor, and she is a national, international, world, and Olympic coach and choreographer at the Detroit Skating Club. It's been a pleasure to talk to both of you. We want to thank you for helping us out with Am I Curious?
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
And if you've got a question for us to dig into, you can submit it on the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.